from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point this week, a prison break, more U.S. presence in Iraq, race and police again, a tough vote on trade. 450 new U.S. military advisors headed for Iraq to bolster the fight against ISIS, says NBC's Richard Engel, from a new base in Anbar.
Between Ramadi and Fallujah, both in ISIS hands. Not to engage in direct combat, administration officials tell us, but to support and equip local forces.
Two convicted killers escape from prison in upstate New York, and the whole country is riveted. Major Charles Guess with the New York State Police.
They could be literally anywhere. We're leaving no stone unturned, but they will be found and apprehended.
And more police controversy this week, this time in McKinney, Texas. At a pool party, a white officer, a young black girl. Here's the CNN report.
The officer, seen wrestling a 14-year-old girl in a swimsuit, pulls his gun towards the crowd.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Major Garrett of CBS News, Laura Barone Lopez of the Huffington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see happening with Iraq, with police, McKinney, Texas, Cleveland, Ohio? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington, Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News. Major Garrett, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
Great to have you here. Also from Washington, Laura Barone Lopez, Congressional Reporter for the Huffington Post. Laura, welcome. Wonderful to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Major, and Laura.
Can we go first to this manhunt? The images just take me back to Bonnie and Clyde movies in the 1930s and the Wayback Machine, but it's very right now. Jack, I was struck, among other things, just how bad these guys are. I mean, convicted murderers, but these are really, really rough guys. They, you know, tie up, torture, the whole works, and all these days, I don't think anyone's ever got out of that prison and been out so long without being recaptured.
It's true. And, you know, this prison break, because of the national attention it's getting, could really color the debate over capital punishment. These escapees, they were serving life sentences without parole. I saw an interview with the brother of one of the people that was murdered. He was a sheriff's deputy. Mm-hmm. And he said, hey, they couldn't have escaped if they had got the death penalty. I think we're going to hear probably more of that. We may even hear it about it with reference to Guantanamo. We're certainly going to hear more about it with reference to so-called supermax prisons.
Laura Barone Lopez, what are you thinking as you see all these images? Roads, back roads lined with officers as far as the eye can see. I mean, they're throwing everything at it. But here we are, what, 5-6 days now? No sign yet. Everybody says they will be captured, but it all sounds like something from an old movie. What do you see here, Laura?
I mean, it does sound a lot like that to me. It's very surprising that it's gone on for so long. It kind of reminds me a bit of the prison break in Southern California of a year or so ago or 2 years ago, where it was that older black man who was the former cop who went on a rampage and took off. I mean, it's something that is very jarring, and at the time I was living in Southern California, so it's not something that the community is, you know, communities are used to.
And this prison, no easy thing to get out of it. Power tools, we all saw what somebody called the governor of New York, Cuomo, playing Tommy Lee Jones, escorting us around, showing us way down in the bowels of the piping of the prison, how they had cut and gone and moved. Suspicion that Joyce Mitchell, a New York prison worker, may have helped them. Here's her ex-husband, Toby Primo, saying that Joyce cheated on him when they were together, and she could have been sweet-talked, he told NBC News.
She's from the country. She's from Dickinson's small town and everything. She could be just a country girl that got sweet-talked by some city guy.
Major, there's been a lot of talk about prison reform in this country. I don't know if all the attention to this case pushes forward on that or pushes back.
I'm not sure it has any effect at all, Tom. Mm-hmm. This is an enormously traumatic event for the communities involved. I mean, people have been interviewed who've been in their homes for 5 or 6 days, told by order of local authorities, don't even come outside. I can only imagine how disruptive that is for work and family life and just the normal rhythms of daily life in and around Dannemora. And you're right there, you can throw almost every movie analogy you want into it, except for the fact that in movies like Shawshank Redemption or The Fugitive, there is some general audience sympathy with the escapee. Not in this case. These are bad actors. They need to be caught. The fact that they have apparently not really moved very far from their original scape site defies me. I covered cops for 6 years early in my career, mm-hmm. spent some time looking at prison issues, and when people get out of a jail or a prison, they tend to run as fast as they can and have a plan of action at least as good as the one that got them out in the first place. That doesn't appear to be the case here. Complicity with inside the prison walls may have gotten them out, but they may not have had much a clue what to do once they get out, and the authorities, in their confidence, public confidence, who guarantee capture, are trying to reassure the public, but they are not as close as their public rhetoric suggests.
You don't want to have the house where these two take shelter. Speculation that Joyce Mitchell was supposed to pick them up and drive them out of there, and that did not happen. Of course, all that yet to be really worked out. What actually went on there? I want to look at Iraq. 450 more U.S. military advisors headed in there now. That will bring the total to something like 3,500. We got a hint that this something like this might be coming, foreshadowing in the way in retrospect. In Germany at the G7 meeting, here was President Obama saying that one of his goals in the fight against ISIS was to get more Iraqi security forces trained.
One of the areas where we're going to have to improve is the speed at which we're training Iraqi forces. Where we've trained Iraqi forces directly and equipped them, and we have a train and assist posture, they operate effectively. Where we haven't, morale, lack of equipment, etc., may undermine the effectiveness of Iraqi security forces.
Major Garrett, the assertion here is that there's no change in strategy, but it's more boots on the ground in a training capacity. They're talking about building a base for them to work out of. As we heard, they are near Ramadi and Fallujah in Anbar. And before the week ended, there was also talk of more bases, maybe marching up toward Mosul. How does this fit into current strategy, Major? And how is it not a kind of mission creep?
Well, it's a gentle evolution, Tom. It's a fine-tuning. There is no revamping of the strategy, because a revamping would call for things like this. Actual combat forces engaged. That's not going to happen. The deployment of Apache attack helicopters from the sky to move as Iraqi ground forces encounter ISIS. That's not going to happen. There will not be any U.S. forces alongside Iraqis as advisors to call in precision airstrikes. John McCain and others have said that's why so many of the U.S. aircraft flying in these coalition airstrikes come back with a half or three quarters of their payload not deployed. Why? Because there's nobody on the ground to tell them what a really good target looks like and when to hit it and why. So if those things were to have been ordered by the president, that would constitute a tremendous change in this policy. This is gradualism. It is important in one sense that there is now going to be a base of operations that the Iraqis created themselves. Al-Takadum is the location, and as it was indicated in the preview to the show, mm-hmm. it's between Fallujah and Ramadi, which means it is potentially subject to attack. Why? Because ISIS controls Fallujah and Ramadi. That's why the ratio here is very important. 450 is not the most important number. 75 is the most important number. That's the number of advisors and trainers. Everyone else, Tom, will be involved in force protection and logistics, meaning all those others are required to protect the 75 carrying out this limited training mission. The other thing that's important to note is this is now in Anbar province. Why does that matter? Because that's where Sunni fighters need to be brought into the fight. Sunni recruits have been almost impossible to find. And the United States and the Iraqi central government have got to find them first before you can accelerate training or even begin training. And the reason they haven't been there is because the Sunnis don't trust the central government in Baghdad, which they believe has Shia sensibilities, to put it mildly, and are not really interested in their long-term political or economic well-being. And until those issues are resolved, it's going to be hard to find recruits, and without recruits, you don't have new trained fighting forces.
And one can imagine the Islamic State. I mean, they took over Mosul, lickety-split. They took over Fallujah, 18 months ago now, and have held it. They took over Ramadi. It didn't look like that big a challenge. One can imagine them turning their sights. We're going to be pushing more arms into this base at Al-Takadum. Surely it may show up on their target list. Laura Barrón-López, what's the mood in Congress about this new step by the White House, the Pentagon, in Iraq?
Well, House Speaker John Boehner was calling it a tactical move, something that he said is a step in the right direction. But at the same time, Republicans still aren't pleased with the authorization of the use of military force that President Obama sent up to them. And so that's why it's really at a
and no action
stalled.
On that yet.
Mm-hmm. There's no action. It's stalled in Congress. So, he said, look, I like this tactical move, but that's what it is. And I would like to see the president, I'd like to see him send up a new AUMF, something that he says is more serious, something that gives him more authority. So, and of course, Democrats are not for that. So it'll be interesting to see if at all a new AUMF is moved on the Hill.
Jack, where do you see the American position with Iraq as we move into a new base, maybe new bases, 450 more, 3,500 now troops?
It looks like it's reinforcing failure, Tom. I mean, the $20 billion that we've spent on training and equipping Iraqi forces since 2003, it's been worse than wasted. Last year, the Iraqi army ran away at first contact with ISIS. Last month, it ran away in Ramadi. And ISIS seizes, as you pointed out, the U.S.-supplied arms that the Iraqis leave behind. The arsenal of democracy under FDR has really become the arsenal of terror under President Obama. And his mission creep here has an unacknowledged strategic dimension. He targets the aid not on the national Iraqi army, but on the Sunni militia in Anbar. Short term, that's almost certain to mean more U.S. weapons leaking to ISIS. But long term, arming the tribes increases the odds of Iraq shattering into shards, Kurdish, Shiite, Sunni. And the president has been more Iraqi than the Iraqis. He wants to keep intact the state carved out by British imperialism. He's leaving the horrors of the breakup of Iraq to his predecessor.
I mean, it looks pretty shattered. Successor. It looks pretty shattered to me right now, Jack, with the Islamic State moved into a big part. And what are you going to do? Just lean back and let the Islamic State grow and be established? We'll look at that with our listeners. Jack, please stand by. Major Garrett with CBS News. It's great to have you here. And Laura Barone Lopez of the Huffington Post, both in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news. More U.S. troops for Iraq, prison break, police, and a Texas pool party. Obama at the G7, Jeb Bush on a European tour, and down to the wire on trade. We'll look at that. Major Garrett is with us, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News, joins us from Washington. Laura Barone Lopez is with us, Congressional Reporter for the Huffington Post. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Is the president right to push up the American troop level in Iraq again, advisors this time? What do you think? Does the G7 look tough enough to face down Vladimir Putin? Does Jeb Bush? And what did you think of the video of the Texas pool party, the cop, the girl, the gun, the scene there? 800-423-TALK is our number. Let's get a call from Odessa, Texas, and David on the Iraq front, if I may. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. The one comment I wanted to make was it seems like Obama's kind of doing a haphazard approach to getting the ISIS situation taken care of in Iraq, because he don't want to renege on his campaign promise of getting us out of Iraq. So he's kicking the can down the road. The next president's going to have to take care of it in full force. And well, that's basically all I had to say.
But David, let me ask you, should he renege on it? I mean, if we go back in full force, we were there for a dozen years and it didn't lead to paradise on earth. Do you want to go back heavy again?
I'm a younger guy and I'm not from the Vietnam generation, but yep. It kind of reminds me of when we sent in trainers to Vietnam. How did that end up? Well, we ended up having to go full force.
Yes, and it didn't work. I mean, that's the lesson that generation took away from the Vietnam War anyway, David. I take your point. We'll hold it. Let me hold it right here, if I may, and get one more. Chris in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Big part of this problem started 70-some years ago when the Western world drew the borders in the Middle East. And I don't know how we can undo that, but I was in Iraq in 05 and 06, and it was really clear back then even, in order to be really truly successful, the United States would have to commit to 30 or 40 years to be there, and that's just not reasonable.
So what do you say, Chris, to our caller in Odessa, Texas, who says, look, we've got going to have to go back in there heavy at some point?
Well, it's just not, I don't think the American public wants that. Again, if we go back in there, we can get control. We can make the whole thing peaceful, even more peaceful than it was the first time we were there. Once we leave, it's going to fall apart, no matter how far we get, unless we're there for a generation or two.
Chris, I appreciate your voice of experience there. Here was the White House spokesman, Josh Earnest, talking about this, saying, look, what's not on the table, it's not going to be large scale, not under this president anyway.
The president's been clear about what's not on the table, and that is a large-scale ground combat operation inside of Iraq. And the reason the president has ruled out that option is the president does not believe it is in the national security interest of the United States for us to do for the Iraqis what they must do for themselves.
Major Garrett, we heard the president say that they still don't really have a strategy fully worked out. He said this in Germany, was in the Bavarian Alps there. What is the plan here? Is this a president who's kind of going to rope-a-dope until he's out of office and the next guy has to deal with it? Or does he think this is truly the best way, somehow is threading here of trying to be a little in but not much?
Well, when the president said we don't yet have a full strategy, what he meant is we don't have, meaning we, the United States, a reliable partner in the Iraqi central government. Haider al-Abadi, the new prime minister, is viewed by the administration as saying far more of the right things and doing some of the right things that his predecessor, Nouri al-Maliki, did not do. The Maliki government was, in every respect, a malevolent force to everyone in Iraq who was not Shia. The Kurds were abused. The Sunnis were abused.
Yeah.
The military was disbanded. Much of the safety and passivity that had been created by the brute force of American military power evaporated, and in that vacuum, many things grew, among them antipathy toward the central government and alliances with ISIS. That's the reality the president finds himself in. General Ray Odierno, who's the chief of staff of the United States Army, was on CBS This Morning earlier this week, and he said this is going to be a 3 to 5 to 7 to 10 year project. So to the callers who say, talk about generational anxiety about being in Iraq for a generation, Tom, we're already there for almost a generation. If you go back to the first Gulf War in 1991, we're at a generational marking post now. If you add another 10 years to this, and the White House did not disagree with Odierno's projection of how long this would take, that's almost a generation and a half. And the underlying political reality in Iraq is, until you create something that has not been created, which is rough sectarian harmony, not nirvana, but just a rough sense of political cohesion, these fissures are going to manifest themselves militarily, and the president does not want to try to use the United States military as the arbiter of that dispute, because he believes it only ends in two things: wasted treasure and more bloodshed.
Laura Barrón-López, we've got to move on from Iraq. We'll talk more about it on this show on Monday, but here's my question for you. You cover Congress in Republican ranks there. Is there really an appetite to get back? I mean, I know John Boehner talks this way. Others do, too. But how deep is, how widespread the appetite to get back in a heavier military way into Iraq?
Well, I actually wouldn't even say that Speaker Boehner is that adamant about, you know, something like having combat boots on the ground or a very heavy force there. I mean, he was very careful this week in saying, look, you know, I'm not going to get into this straw man debate. I just want a stronger AUMF so that way Obama can do what he needs to be able to do in this fight against ISIS. But I'm not saying that, you know, I want all of a sudden hundreds of thousands of troops on the ground. So I think that they're treading a fine line, but also, you know, say that the strategy that Obama has right now, or the lack of a complete strategy, isn't something that they think is going to win this war.
I want to look quickly. I think, Major, you were with the president in the Alps. I don't know if you were wearing your lederhosen. He didn't bring his.
I was not, Tom.
Okay, okay. Well, we won't even picture that, then.
I do have a career to protect, Tom.
right. TV. It's all right out there to see. How's that going? The Russians seem to be more and more assertive in testing NATO all over the place. G7's at the heart of that. Did it look like the president is sitting in the midst of a crew that is up to the Russian challenge?
The president arrived in the Bavarian Alps hoping to get one thing he accomplished, which was a fulsome statement from the G7 that European economic sanctions imposed against Moscow due to expire in July would be extended. when the foreign ministers, about a month before the meeting, suggested as much, that was pretty much baked into the cake. But you never be sure at these meetings, and the president got that. And so the economic sanctions continue. There was a little teeny bit of language in the communique saying, well, if Russia continues to do bad things, we may impose more sanctions. Right now, this was all about maintaining the status quo. The fact of the matter is, it is becoming more difficult for the European nations who are aligned, I don't mean aligned ideologically, but they have economic relationships with Russia that are now being strained because of the sanctions, because they run in both directions. When you sanction the Russian economy, you therefore take some money out of your economy. Yeah. That's becoming a bit of a pressure point in some parts of Europe. And the fatigue factor is beginning to build. So extending them past July was a significant achievement in that context. But no one really knows what the intentions of Vladimir Putin are. And there is great anxiety among the European leaders that this summer could be a summer of more incursions into eastern Ukraine and more decision points for Europe as to how aggressive it wants to be about this. And the grander context is, remember, Ukraine is not a member of NATO, but the Baltic states are. And there is tremendous anxiety in the Baltic states that if having fed upon eastern Ukraine, the appetites of Moscow may turn in that direction. And if they do, this does become a huge NATO issue. And the defense of those countries is absolute under the Article 5 part of the NATO charter. And that's what everyone in Europe is worried about.
Here's the president looking to celebrate that united front, at least this week, Monday in Germany.
Even as we will continue to seek a diplomatic solution, sanctions against Russia will remain in place so long as Russia continues to violate its obligations under the Minsk agreements. Our European partners reaffirm that they will maintain sanctions on Russia until the Minsk agreements are fully implemented.
Jack Beatty, no problem here. We're all arm in arm. Everything's strong and good.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, Major brings up the Baltic state, the financial.
Not Baroque, don't.
Hello.
Hello. We're right here, Jack.
Okay. Yeah. Major brought up the Baltic states. Well, you know, the Financial Times did a big takeout, big reporting from there this week. And they fear subversion, really, among the quarter of their people who are Russian-speaking. Latvia's military has recently practiced attacks on separatists near the Russian border. Lithuania has begun conscription. Estonia says it'll shoot on sight any, quote, little green men, Russian troops in unconvincing mufti, seen on its territory. Poland has erected watchtowers along its borders with a Russian enclave, Kaliningrad. And as Major said, these are NATO members. If one of them is invaded, NATO charter requires all NATO countries, including us, to go to its aid. And the question is, would little green men in Latvia constitute an invasion? You know, you begin to think that Russia has gone to school on China. China's idle island building in the South China Sea. That's a too thin slice of the salami of expansion, really, to warrant fighting over. A new poll shows that half of Germans, French, and Italians are against using force to defend other NATO members. That suggests that the Chinese salami tactics might work against NATO. Are little green men worth a big war with a nuclear power? We don't know.
Jeb Bush was in Germany as well, in Berlin. He's set, of course, to announce his formally, at long last, I guess, after this long interim sort of status, announce his White House bid on Monday, made his first major foreign policy speech in Germany early this week, Tuesday, I guess. Taking questions afterward, here was, candidate-in-waiting Jeb Bush saying Vladimir Putin's a bully.
Ultimately, I think the deal with Putin, you need to deal from strength. He's a bully. And bullies don't, you enable bad behavior when you're nuanced with a guy like that. And I think just being clear, I'm not talking about being bellicose, but saying here are the consequences of your actions.
Laura Barrón-López in Washington, did you hear a strong challenge to the Obama way of foreign policy in those comments from Jeb Bush in Europe?
I actually caught the very tail end of that. So,
sorry, we know you got cut off for a minute, but it's Jeb Bush in Berlin saying Putin's a bully, and you know when you've got bullies, you've got to be tough. You've got to say there are consequences for your actions.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I think that foreign policy, I mean, given all of the issues that are going on right now, and in the G7, of course, Russia was one of the main topics, and the fact that they aren't the G8 anymore. But I think that Jeb, you know, is probably clearly trying to come out as strong as he can because foreign policy is going to be such a big issue, because it ties to just as what we just talked about, which was the war in Iraq with ISIS. On top of that, the issues that are going on with Russia, the Iran nuclear agreement, all these foreign policy issues are going to be Obama is going to be a prime target for Republicans.
Jack Beatty, do you see big room for Jeb Bush to come in with a kind of George W. view of the world and challenge Obama from that angle? Is that what you heard in his Berlin remarks or not?
No, I didn't hear that. Mm-hmm. I heard a gesture toward toughness and then vagueness. Michael McFaul, the former ambassador to Russia, said, well, he didn't talk about this, he didn't talk about that, and he didn't talk about the other, but otherwise it was all right. It was posturing. He's generically tough. He just doesn't want to talk about troops. Or he didn't even raise the issue, so far as I was paying attention, of U.S. aid to Ukraine, military aid. So, he had a successful trip. He hasn't made any gaffes, but there wasn't much there other than a vague sense of we need to be tougher.
Jimbo in Jericho, Vermont. Jimbo, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
I just wanted to say, Jeb, he can't look at Russia like it's Iraq, like his father and his brother did. You know, Iraq actually is a great example of what we could be in store for if we keep on trying to keep our hawkish views on our foreign policy. You know, you can't just bully up like, oh, I'm going to show them and be super Texas. It's like, you know, we really need to think of some better ways to relate with the rest of the world, because that's just how we look.
Do you think Jeb Bush will bring on something more moderate? Do you think that would be his tack?
Unfortunately, not just him. I mean, it could be President Walker. It could, or it could be Congressman Walker. It could be, yep. You know, it could be a lot of hawkish people that we have going up. You know, I really hope Bernie gets up there to go and weigh in some power, because, you know, I was born in 1981 and I've seen nothing but, you know, nonsense coming out of America, and we haven't really solved or fixed anything.
Jimbo, I appreciate your call. Voice of Vermont there speaking up for Bernie Sanders and his candidacy. Big challenges and a lot of mixed signals from Americans coming from experience about the whole idea of going in hard and heavy, and that the challenges are very large. Laura, help us for a minute here. We were talking right in the middle of this, so we don't know where it's going to end up, but you've got this huge trade debate in Washington today. The vote will come after our conversation. The president wants this fast-track clearance for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal with the Pacific. A lot of members of his own party not so sure they want to give him that. What is the core issue that everybody's tangling over? The president up there trying to twist some arms, but what's the heart of it?
So right now, what it's boiling down to is whether or not a faction within the Democratic caucus, so more of the progressives, are going to kill the Trade Adjustment Assistance Bill, which would provide aid to workers that are displaced by trade deals like TPP. Mm-hmm. And Democrats are generally for this. They're the ones that wanted this bill. They're the ones that wanted, to fix a Medicare offset in this bill. And they fought for it all along the way. But progressive Democrats and the majority of the caucus in general is against TPP. They're against fast track authority for Obama. So they're now seeing it as a tool to derail the entire trade agenda. And yesterday, three members of the cabinet, two members of the cabinet and then Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough were up on the Hill meeting with Democrats trying to convince them, no, look, you need to. It was implied that they needed to vote yes for the agenda to help the president out. That seemed to not work. So, like you said, Obama is up there this morning trying to convince them not to throw TAA under the bus, because if TAA goes, trade adjustment assistance, then fast track goes with it, and that will completely hurt the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other trade deals that Obama wants to try to get done.
So many of our listeners may hear this after the vote's taken. If they fail, is this life or death for the whole trade deal, the Pacific trade deal?
It would be very hard to bring it back up again. I do not see how they would have the votes.
Wow, a lot on the line. Listeners, by the time you hear this, the vote may have been taken. There are the stakes. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, American Pharoah wins the Triple Crown, the first horse to do it since 1978.
Here it is. The 37-year wait is over. American Pharoah is finally the one. American Pharoah has won the Triple Crown.
All right. Famed actor Christopher Lee, Dracula, Saruman, James Bond villain, is dead at 93. Here, in one of his many movies as Dracula, he orders a girl to get rid of a cross.
Get that thing out of my sight! Throw it away!
And jazz icon Ornette Coleman died this week at 85, champion of free jazz. Here is Lonely Woman, the opening of his 1959 album, The Shape of Jazz to Come. The great Ornette Coleman right there. Major Garrett is with us today. Chief White House correspondent for CBS News. Laura Barone Lopez is here. Jack Beatty's here. We're looking at a week in the news. More U.S. troops for Iraq. The prison break. Police and a Texas pool party. We'll get right to that. Obama at the G7. Jeb in Europe. Down to the wire today on trade. I want to get to McKinney, but let's just take one more on trade. Nate in Milwaukee. Thank you for calling, Nate. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I was calling to express my dismay at a provision that's been reported that was included in the TPP agreement stating that it could not deal at all with global warming. And this was to go along with a Republican congressman from my own state, Mr. Sensenbrenner. And it goes right along with Republican efforts to say the EPA shouldn't deal with global warming, which is kind of ridiculous. And if global warming is an international problem, it should be in international agreements. And I think this, to say this would be an embarrassment to the world by making a mess of it would be perhaps too kind.
Nate, I appreciate your call. Major Garrett, you cover the White House. The White House is pushing so hard on this front. They've got a lot of people in their own party saying, wait a minute, this is going to tie America's hands on all kinds of fronts that have to do with American labor's welfare, and this issue of climate change has come up as well, and the freedom of the U.S. to move on that front. What's the counter message, if there is one, Major, from the White House?
In a nutshell, the counter message is this president is a progressive Democrat who is negotiating a trade deal that's better than any that have come before it. Now, there are some Democratic critics who say it's not good enough. It may be better. There might be more environmental regulations or standards that other nations who are signatories will have to live under. Same thing with labor and human rights standards. Those have been side agreements before, things that have been part of the general text but easily ignorable in the past. That was certainly the case with NAFTA. The president says they're no longer side agreements. They're central to the document itself and therefore should win the support of Democrats. House Democrats have another real problem that has nothing to do with the merits. It has to do with their own political viability, which is every labor union in this country, every single one, opposes fast track, which is not the trade deal itself. It's the process by which Congress would consider it without amendments. And if you're a House Democrat and you fear a primary over this vote, you need the president to provide real-time, reliable political cover. That's something that President Obama could do in year 2, 3, 4, 5. Maybe he can do it in 6. In year 7, when he's a full-blown lame duck, doubtful. And so what House Democrats have to do is decide whether or not they're going to give their loyalty to the president on this larger ideological issue of free trade, establishing more U.S. involvement in the ever-expanding global economy, or a more intimate calculation about their own political viability vis-a-vis labor unions, which are enormous grassroots and financial contributors within the Democratic Party. And that's going to be the conversation. I think Laura would back me up on this in the Democratic cloakroom all today.
Big vote on the trade front today. By the time you hear this, that may have been taken. Big consequences, as Laura Barone Lopez and Major Garrett, big implications as they describe. I want to go to McKinney, Texas. Yet another story in what has now become this long drumbeat of race and police incidents. They certainly become that when the video, when the stories hit the national picture. McKinney, Texas, outside Dallas, a town of black and white, of fairly well-off and not so well-off. On Sunday, pool party, somebody called the police, said it was getting out of hand. They came, but there was already tension in the air. Here's a little tape of 19-year-old Tatiana Rhodes. She was hosting the pool party in McKinney, Texas. African-American, 19-year-old resident there, described an altercation she had with a white neighbor before the police even arrived.
They're like, well, you need to go back where you're from and things like that, telling me I need to go back to my Section 8 home and stuff like that. So I said, excuse me, and then the other lady, her name's Kate, came up to me and she smacked me in my face.
It was a private pool. But a good sized one at a development there. It was things getting maybe a little out of hand. The police came. We all have seen the images of the 14, 15-year-old girl pushed to the ground by the policeman, you know, there in her bikini, straight at the just outside the pool area, everybody running and screaming. The pistol briefly comes out at a press conference of community leaders on Monday in McKinney. Here was Jahi Adisa Bakari, the father of one of the girls that Officer Eric Casebolt allegedly pushed, spoke out against that behavior.
The fact of the matter, this officer recklessly attacked this young lady who was following his instruction to leave. That wasn't acceptable enough for him. So when my daughter, she came in, he just punched her to the side.
Well, the whole country watched and responded. So did the police there. There's the police chief of McKinney, Texas. And he's announcing that Casebolt had resigned from the police force. This was at a press conference on Tuesday.
The actions of Casebolt, as seen on the video of the disturbance at the community pool, are indefensible. Our policies, our training, our practice do not support his actions. He came into the call out of control, and as the video shows, was out of control during the incident.
This comes in now a long string of stories. Jack, Major, Laura, I'll bring it to you. Our listeners first, Calvin in Sumter, South Carolina. Calvin, you're on the air. Hello, Calvin, are you there? Let's get another from Sam in Newton, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I think it's pretty clear that we have a systemic nationwide problem with police and excessive force. The video of this cop running around, falling down, getting up, chasing these kids, whipping out his pistol against two boy teenagers, his 200-pound-plus frame, holding down this 14-year-old girl in a bikini, I think says it all. Now, it's either a problem with training or it's a problem with the attitude that cops have that they cannot be challenged. I read an article about the police in Baltimore who are saying they're afraid to react now. Well, it sounds like they're getting a small taste of the fear that the citizens of Baltimore have against the police. And it really has to be dealt with because police carry lethal weapons, and we cannot have police out of control. It just doesn't do much for the confidence that the citizens have for the police carrying out their duties safely and effectively.
Sam, I totally get that perspective. When you look at this video, you think, what's going on here? I read, maybe you did too, I mean, when you look at it in a whole context, this officer, Eric Casebolt, had just come from a couple of other pretty intense interactions that day. He had helped console the grieving widow of a man who had shot himself in the head in front of his children, and had helped photograph that body. And in a separate incident, he was calling a teenage girl, threatening to commit suicide by jumping off her parents' roof. And then he shows up at this pool party. Any excuse? Any explanation there, Sam? We're still not excusable.
I read that too, but police cannot use the excuse that they had traumatic events and that justifies excessive force. Police are supposed to be trained to deal with situations like that above and beyond what a normal citizen would.
Yeah, fair enough, Sam. I appreciate your call. Let me get one right from Texas, San Antonio, Texas. Ariel, you're on the air.
Yes, I watched the whole video, and it was disturbing to me.
because if you remember Eric Garner in New York, the whole I can't breathe situation, that's exactly what it reminded me of. And thankfully, this child wasn't hurt. If you are an adult and you cannot deal with children cursing at you, being unruly, maybe you should rethink your career, because I think that could have been handled very differently.
Well, Officer Casebold, at least rethinking his job right now. He's resigned and he's out. But, yeah, the sense that the adults ultimately took it out of hand. One more, and I'll come to you, Laura, first, I guess. Calvin in Sumter, South Carolina. Calvin, you're on.
Hello, how you doing?
Okay, what do you see, Calvin?
Speaking on a father, especially a black father.
Yes, sir.
We're paying very close attention to this, what's going on. And it's a blatant disrespect for black lives. The situation that happens with the extreme force that's being used by police officers toward blacks is only happening towards blacks. And we know this is happening, and we're tired of it. Now, we don't have a problem with them doing their job, but the problem is they're not doing their job. They're coming there with a bias. They come in there dealing with innocent people and dealing with them with extreme force, extreme, you know, deadly force, or however you want to do it. The conversation in our community is this.
Yes.
If they do not correct themselves, fathers are feeling, I'm just telling you, this is the conversation that's going on.
Yes.
Fathers are feeling they have to protect their families by any means necessary. And that's the problem. I mean, if they don't correct it and we don't tackle this, because everybody keeps trying to avoid it, even down to the president, we keep trying to avoid talking about this issue, and we need to talk about this issue because it's been going on since we've been here. And we've never had a communication or a line of communication with the police department. It's never been. And we need to stop acting like it does, because it does not exist. The only thing is, the purpose of the police department was to recapture slaves, and they've still been doing that. U.S. Constitution states that slavery was abolished except for the commitment of a crime, and that's exactly what they're doing. That's why we're loading up the jails, and that's why the justice system doesn't work for us, and we know this.
Calvin, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. A black father not happy, talking with others not happy, emotion and reaction running high here. Major Garrett, I'll come to you, Laura Barone-Lopez, first. The video like this comes out, and it's just one more in this series now. And you hear this black father in South Carolina saying, enough, 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 and tracing it right back to very, very difficult racial history in this country.
Yes, I mean, it is very troubling. Watching the entire video, I have multiple times now, and there really is no excuse for the police officer's actions, in my opinion. I agree with the fact that he resigned and that they immediately put him on leave before he decided to do that. I think that, yes, it does speak to a problem that the country is having to deal with now. It's not, as the father said, it's a problem that has been there. It's persisted and it's festered and it's been growing. And only now, partly because of the fact that we do have, you know, this technology and cameras and everyone has a camera phone now, that it is reaching the masses and is forcing everyone to pay attention to it when they otherwise wouldn't have. But yes, I understand his frustration because of the fact that Congress isn't, I don't know if Congress exactly knows what to do or, you know, what steps can be taken other than trying to fund, give more money to the states, to the police departments to be able to, so that way more are able to have body cameras, because it does boil down to a state issue.
And what's known, what's understood. Jack, I'll come to you. Major Garrett, I mean, people want to respond to this. You hear our father in South Carolina is thinking about responses. It shouldn't have to go there. You have this judge in Cleveland this week in the death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who was shot by police a couple seconds after they jumped out of his car, their car. He had a toy gun, though, in fairness. It looked like a pretty serious weapon, but 12 years old, dead in a couple of seconds. This judge saying there's probable cause even before the grand jury comes out. What about the president of the United States? Does the White House feel pressure to somehow do more in leading at this time when here we have our first African-American president and we have race relations just mounting up to some kind of state that I hadn't seen in a long time, Major?
This is a dilemma for the president, and I know he is personally agonized over exactly where to come down and to assess his proportional voice in this larger national debate. By that I mean, how much do you come on the side of those who feel aggrieved, maybe for generations, maybe for the entire history of our country, at the hands of police or authority? And how much do you say police officers carry out an enormously important task, and we have to respect them, and we have to understand that there's a legal process? The president has tried to walk that very fine line. To the satisfaction, I would say, based on reaction I've received, to almost no one, because no one feels as if he's taking the issue on as directly or as passionately as they would prefer. The president has decided to try to walk this fine line and do some of the things that Laura suggested, put together this task force on improved community policing, more funding of body cameras, and more rewarding of police departments, and partnering for the federal government, police departments that take on the actual hard work of retraining and improving tactics on the ground. Just a couple of observations about what happened in McKinney, having covered cops for 6 years. Mm-hmm. That officer, after the suicide and the other encounter with the teenage girl, should have been off duty. I mean, I can't think of a police department that would not say to that officer, get off duty. Every police department, under circumstances of that nature, should have a protocol so that officer is not so traumatically wound up that he goes out of control.
Jack, all the video is leading to a national conversation here. Do you think it's leading toward a new consensus, or a consensus that we need a change?
I think it is, and I think this Nostrum community policing, we're going to hear more and more about it, because it tries to take down the wall between the police and the people, and that's essential here.
Body cameras are not. Video is out in the world, and we see it, and people are not happy with what they're seeing lately. Major Garrett with CBS News, Chief White House Correspondent. Thank you so much, Major.
My pleasure.
Laura Barone Lopez with the Huffington Post. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
This is On Point.